Chapter 2. Dawn found the surprise far out in the grey, lonely waste that was her natural home. A fine-to-gallant breeze was blowing from the southwest, with low cloud and occasional wafts of rain, but promise of a better day to come. And she hit to Gansel's abroad, although it was so early, for Jack wished to be out of the ordinary path of ships on their way to or from the various naval stations. He had no wish to see any of his men pressed, and no king's officer could resist the temptation of such a numerous, hand-picked crew of able seamen. Nor had he any wish to be called aboard a king's ship to show his papers, give an account of himself, and perhaps be treated in an off-hand manner, even with familiarity or disrespect. The service was not made up solely of men with a great deal of natural or acquired delicacy, and he had already had to put up with some slights. He would get used to them in time, no doubt, but for the present he was, as it were, flayed.
"Get under way, Joe,"
said the quartermaster, turning the watch-glass, and a muffled form padded forward to strike three bells in the morning watch. The master's mate heaved the log and reported 6 knots, 2 fathoms, a rate few ships could equal in these conditions and perhaps none surpass.
"Mr. West,"
said Jack to the officer of the watch,
"I'm going below for a while. I doubt the breeze will hold, but it looks as though we may have a pleasant day of it."
"It does indeed, sir," replied West, ducking his head against a sudden shower of spray,
for the Surprise was sailing close-haul to south-southeast, with choppy seas smacking against her starboard bow and streaming aft, mixed with the rain.
"How delightful it is to be at sea once more."
At this early stage, Jack Aubrey was 3 persons in 1. He was the ship's captain, of course, and since no candidate he could approve had appeared among the many who came forward, he was also her master, responsible for the navigation, among other things. And he was her purser as well. Officers commanding vessels sent on exploration were usually their pursers too, but this role had never fallen to Jack, and although as captain he had always been supposed to supervise his pursers and required to sign their books, he was astonished at the volume and complexity of the necessary accounts now that he came to deal with them in detail. There was already light enough to work at the stern window of the great cabin, a curving series of panes the whole width of the ship that gave him a certain pleasure even at the worst of his unhappiness, as indeed did the cabin itself, a singularly beautiful room with scarcely a right angle in it, curved deck head, inclined sides. And with its 24 feet of breadth and 14 of length, it provided him with more space than all the other officers together. And this was not everything, since out of the great cabin there opened 2 smaller ones, one for dining, the other for sleeping. The dining cabin, however, had now been made over to Stephen Maturin, and when breakfast arrived, Jack, having dealt with almost 1/3 of the invoices, advice notes and bills of lading, nodded towards its door and asked,
"Is the doctor stirring?"
"Never a sound, sir," said Killick, "which he was mortal tired last night, like a foundered horse. But maybe the smell will wake him. It often does."
The smell, a combination of coffee, bacon, sausages and toasted soft tack, had woken him in many latitudes, for like most sailors, Jack Aubrey was intensely conservative in the matter of food, and even on very long voyages he generally contrived, by carrying hens, pigs, a hardy goat and sacks of green coffee, to have much the same breakfast, apart from the toast, on the equator or beyond the polar circles. It was a meal that Maturin looked upon as England's chief claim to civilization. Yet this time even the coffee did not rouse him. Nor did the cleaning of the quarterdeck immediately over his head, nor the piping up of hammocks at 7 bells, nor that of all hands to breakfast at 8, with the roaring, rushing and bellowing that this always entailed. He slept on and on, through the gradual dropping of the wind and through the wearing of the ship to the larboard tack, with all the hauling, bracing, round and coiling down that accompanied the manoeuvre. And it was not until well on in the forenoon watch that he emerged, gaping and stretching, with his breeches undone at the knee and his wig in his hand.
"Guardian Mary with you, gentlemen," said Padine, who had been waiting for him.
"Guardian Mary and Patrick with you, Padine," said Stephen.
"Will they bring a clean shirt and hot water for shaving now?"
Stephen considered, rasping his chin.
"You might bring the water," he said. "The weather is calm, I find, the motion slight, the danger inconsiderable.
As for the shirt," he went on, raising his voice to overcome the cheerful conversation of a working party 11 inches above him, "as for the shirt, I have one on already and do not mean to take it off. But you may desire preserved killick to favour me with a pot of coffee." The last was said still louder, and in English, since there was a strong likelihood that Killick, always intensely curious, would hear it. Some time later, shaved and refreshed, Dr. Maturin came on deck. That is to say, he walked out of his cabin by the forward door, along the passage to the waist of the ship, and so up the ladder to the quarterdeck, upon which the captain, the first mate, the boatswain, and the gunner were in consultation. Stephen made his way to the taffrail and leaned there in the sun, looking forward the whole length of the ship, some 40 yards, to the point where the rising bowsprit carried it farther still. The day had indeed turned out to be pleasant, but the breeze was on the wane, and in spite of a noble spread of canvas, the Surprise was making no more than 2 or 3 knots, with barely a tilt on her deck. Everything looked superficially the same. The familiar sun-filled white curves above, the taut rigging and its severe shadows, and he had to search for some while before he could tell where the essential difference lay. It was not in the lack of naval uniforms, for except in flagships and some others commanded by very quarter-deck captains, it was now quite usual for officers to wear nondescript working clothes unless they were invited to dine in the cabin or were engaged upon some official duty. And as for the hands, they had always dressed as they pleased. Nor was it the absence of a man-of-war's pennant streaming from her masthead, which he would never have noticed. No, part of it lay in the absence of the marines' scarlet coats, always a striking patch of colour against the pale deck and the unemphatic variations of the sea, and in that of boys of any kind, ship's boys or young gentlemen on the quarter-deck. They were not much use. They took up valuable room. It was difficult to make them quietly attentive to their duty, but they did add a certain shrill cheerfulness. Cheerfulness was still present. In fact, it was considerably more audible, hands laughing in the tops, along the gangway and on the forecastle, than it would have been in the Royal Navy under an equally taut captain. But it was of a different nature. Stephen was pondering upon this further difference when Bondon came aft to attend to the ensign, a red one, which had become entangled, and they had a word.
"The hands are most uncommon pleased about Lord Nelson's letter, sir," said Bondon, after they had discussed the breeze and the possibility of taking codlings with hook and line. "They look upon it as what you might call a sign."
At this point the boatswain's pipe called Bondon and all hands to get the blue cutter over the side, and Jack walked aft.
"Good morning to you, sir," said Stephen. "I am sorry not to have seen you at breakfast, but I slept as the person in Plutarch that ran from Marathon to Athens without a pause would have slept, if he had not fallen dead, the creature. Poor Martin is sleeping yet, blisters and all. Lord, how we skipped along so pitifully anxious not to miss the boat. Sometimes, on very steep hills, he led me by the hand."
"Good morning to you, Doctor, and a pretty one it is," said Jack. "Mr. Martin is aboard, then? I had imagined he was gone home to make his arrangements, and that he would rejoin when we put into Shelmerston again."
"Sure, I had no time to speak to you about him or anything else yesterday afternoon, and at night I was asleep before ever you came below. And even now, although this is not the Admiral's supper table," he said quietly, looking at the wheel, which in the Surprise was just forward of the mizzenmast, 10 feet away, with its helmsman and the quartermaster at the conn, to say nothing of the officer of the watch by the capstan, and a party of seamen running up the shrouds to arm the mizzen-top, "it is scarcely a place that I should choose for confidential talk."
"Let us go below," said Jack.
"And even here," said Stephen, in the cabin, "even in what seems the true penetralia of the frigate, little is said that does not become known in a more or less distorted form throughout the ship by nightfall. I do not allege any malignance, any wicked evil intent in any soul aboard, yet it is a fact that the people are already aware of Lord Nelson's letter. They know, that is to say, they believe they know, that the Surprise was bought by a syndicate of which I was the mouthpiece, while its members almost certainly include my former patient, Prince William. And they know that Martin has put off his clerical character for that of a surgeon, he having been unfrocked for rogering—do you know the expression, rogering, Jack?"
"I believe I have heard it."
"His bishop's wife, unfrocked, and therefore incapable of bringing us bad luck. As for his presents, I did suggest that he should go home with an advance on his pay, as you were so very kind as to give me long, long ago, and come aboard with his sea-chest when we next put in. But he preferred to send his wife the advance and to stay aboard. His affairs are in a desperate way, I am afraid. No hope of a living, none of a naval chaplaincy since his unfortunate pamphlet, and an inimical father-in-law, and he is in danger of an arrest for debt if he returns. Besides, although we are to be out only a fortnight, he is happy to put up with the inconvenience of no spare shirt and shoes worn through on the off chance of our taking a prize. I explained our system of shares, which he had not understood, and fourpence would make him happy. There are other things, however, that I have been most impatient to tell you. Suppose we climb into the top when those men have finished what they are at?
They will be some time yet, said Jack,
who had climbed into the top with Stephen before this.
Perhaps a better plan would be to pull round the ship in your skiff after the great gun practice. In any case, I wish to look at her trim.
Would you be intending to exercise the great guns directly?
Why, yes. Did you not see the blue cutter going over the side with the targets? Now that we are in an out-of-the-way corner of the sea, I should like to find how the new hands shape with live ammunition. We mean to fire half a dozen rounds, starblins against larblins, before dinner. We shall have to look precious sharp.
Targets away, sir, said Pullings at the cabin door. And he did, in fact, look sharp, as keen as a terrier shown a rat, in striking contrast to Jack Aubrey. Stephen had the impression that his friend would not greatly care if the targets quietly sank of their own accord, and this impression was strengthened during the first part of the exercise. The stimulus of Nelson's letter and the Admiral's kindness had long since died away. Somberness had returned. This somberness was not accompanied by any lack of conduct. Aubrey had far too strong a sense of duty to his ship to be anything but exact and punctilious. Yet Stephen observed that even the smell of the slow match, the splitting crash of a gun, the screech and twang of its recoil, and the powder smoke eddying along the deck did not really move him now. He also observed that Pullings, who loved Jack Aubrey, was watching him with anxiety. What Stephen did not observe was that the great gun and musketry exercise was exceedingly poor, for these activities had usually taken place in the evening when all hands were piped to quarters, to their action stations, and as surgeon his was far below where the casualties were to be received. He had little experience and almost no appreciation of the frigate's outstanding gunnery in former times. Jack Aubrey, from his earliest dawn of naval reason, and even more certainly from his very first command, had been convinced that accurate, rapid gunfire had more to do with victory than polished brass. He had worked on this principle in all his successive ships, and he had brought the Surprise, which he had commanded longest, to a high pitch of excellence. In good conditions, HMS Surprise had fired 3 accurate broadsides in 3 minutes 8 seconds, which in his opinion no other ship in the Navy could equal, far less surpass. The present Surprise, though shorn of her HMS, nevertheless carried all her old guns. Willful Murder, Jumping Billy, Belcher, Sudden Death, Tom Crib and the rest, together with many of her old gun crews. But in order to produce a united ship's company, or rather to prevent more animosity and division than was inevitable, Jack and Pullings had mixed old men and new. The result was pitifully slow, blundering and inaccurate. Most of the privateer's men were much more accustomed to boarding their opponents than to battering them from a distance. Apart from anything else, a battering was sure to spoil the victim's merchandise, and few were qualified to point a gun with anything like precision. Many a nervous look did the old Surprises throw at the captain, for in general he was a most unsparing critic. But they saw no reaction of any kind, nothing but an unmoved gravity. Only once did he call out, and that was to a new hand who was too close to his gun.
"The boarder at number 6, James. Stand free, or you will lose your foot on the recoil."
The last shot was fired, the gun sponged, reloaded, wadded, rammed, and run out.
"Well, sir," said Davidge uneasily. "Let's see what they can do with the larboard guns, Mr. Davidge," said Jack.
"How's your guns?" called Davidge, and then, "All hands about ship."
The newcomers might be weak on gunnery, but they were thoroughgoing seamen,
and they ran as fast as the surprises to their appointed sheets, tacks, bowlines, braces, and backstays, and the familiar cries followed.
"The helm's alee! Off tacks and sheets!"
But the full-voiced
"Mainsail haul!"
was immediately followed by a shrieking hail from the masthead.
"On deck there! Sail 1 point on the larboard bow!"
The sail could be seen even from the deck, bringing up the breeze at a fine pace. The lookout had obviously been watching the exercise rather than the horizon. The surprise paid off. Jack laid her for topsail aback, and slinging his telescope, he made his way to the top. From there she was hull up, and even without the glass he could tell what she was. A big cutter, one of those fast, nimble, weatherly 200- or 300-ton vessels used by smugglers, or those who pursued smugglers. She was very trim for a smuggler. Too trim. And presently the telescope showed him the man-of-war's pennant, clear against the mainsail. She had the weather gauge, but the surprise could almost certainly outsail her going large. Yet this would mean running right out into the regular track of shipping, and the likelihood of being brought to by some rated man-of-war that would rob him of many more men than a cutter. And escape by beating to windward was out of the question. No square-rigged ship could lie as close as a cutter. He returned to the deck and said to the officer of the watch,
"Mr. Davidge, we shall lie to until she comes up and continue the exercise afterwards. Stand by to dip topsails and ensign."
There was a murmur, more than a murmur, of strong disapproval from the new hands at the quarterdeck carronades, most unwilling to be pressed, and one said,
"She's only the Viper, sir, nothing like as swift as us before the wind."
"Silence there,"
cried Davidge, striking at the man's head with his speaking trumpet. Jack went below, and after a moment he sent for Davidge.
"Oh, Mr. Davidge," he said, "I have told West and Mr. Bulkley, but I do not think I have mentioned it to you. There will be no starting in this ship, no damning of eyes or souls. There is no room for hard horse officers in a private man of war."
Davidge would have replied, but a look at Jack's face checked his words. If ever there was a hard horse officer ready with a frightful blow regardless of persons, it was Jack Aubrey at this moment. Killick silently brought in a respectable coat, blue, but with no naval marks or lace or buttons. Jack put it on and began to gather the papers that he should have to present if he were called aboard. He looked up as Stephen came in and said with a forced smile,
"You have a paper too, I see."
"Listen, brother," said Stephen, drawing him to the stern window. "It is not without some inward wrestling that I produce this, because there was a tacit assumption that it was designed to cover our South American voyage alone. Yet the carpenter tells me that this Viper is commanded by a peculiarly busy coxcomb, a newly appointed lieutenant who is habitually rude and tyrannical, and it appears to me that if the puppy were to be as provoking as I fear he may be, you might commit yourself, and there would be no voyage to South America, no voyage at all."
"By God, Stephen," said Jack,
reading the document, which was the Admiralty's letter of exemption from impressment for the entire ship's company.
"I admire your judgment. I have looked at the Navy list, and Viper is commanded by the son of that scrub in Port Mahone, Dixon. It might have been hard to avoid kicking him if he gave himself airs. By God, I shall be easy in my mind now."
Even so, Jack Aubrey required all his self-command, more indeed than he thought he possessed, to avoid kicking the young man. For the loss of almost all pleasurable emotion left susceptibility, irritation, anger, and rage intact, or in fact strengthened, except during his long periods of apathy. And this was not one of them. When the Viper was within hailing distance, she ordered the Surprise to come under her lee, to send her master aboard with his papers, and to look hellfire quick about it, the order being emphasized with a gun across her bows. Jack was pulled across in the target towing boat, and on going aboard the Viper, a mere 2 steps up the side, these vessels being so low in the water, he saluted the quarterdeck. The youth who had the watch, a master's mate, made a sketchy motion towards his hat and told him that the captain was busy. He would see Mr. Aubrey later. With this he returned to his conversation with the captain's clerk, walking up and down and talking with an affectation of easiness. Cutter's midshipmen were notorious in the service for ill-breeding, and the Vipers ran true to form, leaning against the rail with their hands in their pockets, staring, whispering, sniggering, and staring again. Farther forward, the cutter's warrant officers had gathered in a body, watching with silent disapproval, and a middle-aged seaman who had sailed with Jack many years before stood motionless at the bitts, with a coil of rope in his hands and a look of positive horror on his face. At length, the captain of the Viper received him in the low booth that passed for a cabin. Dixon was sitting at a table. He did not offer Aubrey a chair. He had hated him from those remote days in Menorca, and ever since the surprise had heaved in sight, he had been preparing sarcastic remarks of a particularly cutting nature. But the sight of Jack's bulk towering there, filling the meagre space and all the more massive since he had to crouch under the low deckhead, his grim face and the natural authority that emanated from him, overcame young Dixon's resolution. He said nothing when Jack pushed some objects from a locker and sat down. It was only when he had leafed through the papers that he said, "I see you have a very full ship's company, Mr. Aubrey. I shall have to relieve you of a score or so."
"They are protected," said Jack.
"Nonsense. They cannot be protected. Privateersmen are not protected."
"Read that," said Jack,
gathering up the other papers and standing over him. Dixon read it, again, and held the paper against the light to see the watermark. While he did so, Jack gazed out of the scuttle at his boat's crew's tarpaulin-covered hats, rising and falling on the gentle swell. "Well," said Dixon at last, "I suppose there is nothing more to be said. You may go."
"What did you say?"
said Jack, turning short upon him. "I said there is nothing more to say."
"Good day to you, sir."
"Good day to you, sir." His boat's crew greeted him with radiant smiles, and as they neared the Surprise, one of the Shelmerston men called out to his friends, peering over the hammocks, "Mates, we'm protected!"
"Silence in the boat!" cried the coxswain in a shocked voice.
"Silence fore and aft!"
called the officer of the watch as the cheering spread. Jack's mind was still too full of Stephen's paper and its possible implications to take much notice of the din, and he hurried below. But scarcely was his file in its proper place before a far greater hullabaloo broke out. As the Viper filled and gathered way, all the men from Shelmerston and all those Surprises who were deserters raced up into the weather shrouds facing the cutter. The yeoman of the sheets called out, "One, two, three," and they all bellowed, "Hoo, hoo, hoo," and slapped their backsides in unison, laughing like maniacs.
"Belay there!" roared Jack in a Cape Horn voice. "God-damned pack of moon calves! Is this a bawdy house? The next man to slap his ass will have it flogged off him. Mr. Pullings, the doctor's skiff over the side directly, if you please, and let three more targets be prepared."
"Stephen,"
he said, resting on his oars some 200 yards from the frigate,
"I cannot tell you how grateful I am for that exemption. If any of our old shipmates, who are deserters, had been taken, and I am sure that poor, mean-spirited young hound would not have spared them, they would have run the risk of hanging, of several hundred lashes in any case, and we should have been perpetually playing hide-and-seek with king's ships. For although a little common sense will generally keep you out of the way of any squadron, you cannot be nearly so sure of cruisers. I believe I must not ask you how you came by it."
"I shall tell you, however," said Stephen, "for I know you are as silent as the tomb where discretion is required. On this South American journey I shall hope to make some contacts that may be of interest to government. In a hemi-demi-semi-official way, the Admiralty is aware of this. It is also aware that I cannot reach South America in a ship stripped of its hands. That is why this protection was given. I should have told you before. Indeed, there are many things that I should have told you had we not been so far apart, or had they been fit subjects for correspondence." Stephen paused, staring at a distant kittiwake. Then he said, "Listen now, Jack, till I gather my wits and try to tell you the present position. It is difficult, because I am not master of what I can say, so much of what I know having been told me in confidence. And then again, I cannot remember how much I told you during that horrible time. The details are clouded in my memory. However, grosso modo, and including what you obviously know, this is how things stand. The case for your innocence was that Palmer was under great obligation to you, and by way of return he told you that a peace treaty was being signed,
that prices would rise on the stock exchange, and that you would be well advised to buy certain stocks in anticipation of that rise. The case for your guilt was that there was no Palmer at all, and that you yourself spread the rumour, in short, that you rigged the market. At the time we could not produce Palmer, and in front of such a judge our case was hopeless. Later, however, and now I come to a part of which I believe you know little or nothing, some of my associates and I, helped by a most intelligent thief-taker, found Palmer's body.
Why, then?
Jack, I beg you will not require me to be more explicit or break my train of thought. As I have said, I am not a free agent, and I have to steer very carefully along my line. Another pause, while he considered, and the boat rode smoothly on the swell. Palmer's principals, the men who had put him up to deceiving you, had him knocked on the head. As a cadaver, and a mutilated, legally useless cadaver at that, he could not compromise them. His principals were French agents, Englishmen highly placed in the English administration. But in this case their chief motive was to make money. They wished the market to be rigged, but to be rigged or apparently rigged by some other person. One of these men was Ray. Do not interrupt, Jack, I beg. And since he was perfectly aware of your movements and of your presence aboard the cartel, he was able to arrange the sequence of events with striking success. Yet although this was obvious enough after the event, we might never have found out that Ray and his friend were the prime movers if an ill-used French agent, in this case a Frenchman, had not given them away. Stephen contemplated for a while, then, feeling in his pocket, he brought out a great blue diamond that half filled his hollowed palm. He rolled it gently so that it flashed, blazing in the sun, and went on. I will tell you this, Jack. The Frenchman was that Duhamel with whom we had so much to do in Paris. Diana had tried to ransom us with this pretty thing, and part of the agreement when we left was that it should eventually be restored. Duhamel brought it. And then, in exchange for a service I was able to do him, he not only gave me the name of Ray and his colleague Ledward, Edward Ledward, but set them as elegant a trap as Ray set for you. They were both members of Buttons, and while I watched from the window of Black's, he met them in St. James's Street, just outside their club, gave them a packet of bank notes, and received a report on English military and naval movements and English relations with the Swedish court. My associates and I crossed the street within a very short time, but I most bitterly grieve to say that we bungled it. When we asked for Ray and his friend, they were denied, wished to receive no visitors. Most unhappily, one of my companions tried to force his way in. This made a noise, and by the time we had the proper warrant, they had bolted, not through the kitchen or the stable doors, for we had men on each, but through a little small skylight in the roof, and so along the parapets to Mother Abbott's, where one of the girls let them in, thinking it was a frolic. They went to ground, and so far those in charge of the matter have not been able to tell where. Ledward must have had some suspicion that he was in danger. His papers told my friends nothing at all, and they fear he may long since have arranged for an intelligent way of escape. Ray was less cautious, however, and from what was found at his house it is clear that he was implicated in the stock exchange business and that he profited largely from it. In any case, the report they handed to Duhamel was utterly damning, particularly as some of the information can only have come from inside the Admiralty. There, I think I've told you all I can. It is hardly worth adding that my colleagues, who never thought you could have been anything more than indiscreet with those vile stocks and shares, are now wholly convinced of your innocence. For the last few minutes, Jack's heart had been beating with steadily greater strength and speed, and now it seemed to fill his chest. Breathing deeply and controlling the pitch of his voice with some success, he said,
"Does that mean I may be reinstated?"
"If there were any justice in the world, I am sure it would, my dear," said Stephen. "But you must not look for it with any kind of certainty, never with any kind of strong hope at all. Ledward and Ray have not been taken. They cannot be brought to trial. It is not impossible that someone more highly placed than either is protecting them. Certainly there is a strange reluctance to move.
In any case, the Ministry has no wish to offer the opposition a blazing and most discreditable scandal, and raison d'état may very easily outweigh wrongs inflicted upon an individual, particularly an individual with no political interest, or even indeed with the reverse, for in that respect you will allow me to say that General Aubrey is a sad handicap. Then again, all authority implies an extreme reluctance to admit past error. On the other hand, I believe a friend would advise you not to despair, above all, not to give way to melancholy. Be not idle, be not alone, as dear Burton says, for activity, naval activity, is the solution, if solution there be.
I am sorry if I seemed so hipped this morning, said Jack. The fact of the matter is, I do not mean to complain, Stephen, but the fact of the matter is, I had just had a dream so real and true that even now I can touch it. The dream was that the whole affair, the trial, and everything that followed, was itself a dream, and my huge relief, my joy at realizing this, my immense happiness, I think it was, that woke me. But even then I was still partly in the dream, and for a moment I looked confidently for my old uniform coat.
He dipped his oars and completed his circle round the ship, looking attentively at her trim. His reason acquiesced in everything Stephen had said, but in his irrational part a very small glow was dissipating the most extreme unhappiness. As he pulled towards the frigate, he said,
"I'm glad you saw Duhamel again. I liked him."
"He was a good man," said Stephen, "and restoring this diamond when he was cutting all ties with his own country, going to Canada, was as striking an example of liberal behaviour as I can recall. I regret him much."
"He is not dead, poor fellow?"
"I should not have mentioned his name if he had been living. No, Heneage Dundas, on my guarantee, was to carry him to America, where he meant to settle by the bank of a trout stream in the province of Quebec. He had changed all his not inconsiderable fortune into gold, which he carried in a belt about his waist. He went aboard at Spithead in a turbulent sea, and as I have sometimes done, he slipped between the boat and the side. His fortune sunk him without the least hope of recovery."
"I am heartily sorry for it," said Jack, and rowed a little harder.
He wondered whether he might speak of Diana and her diamond. It seemed inhuman not to do so. But he decided that the matter was altogether too delicate. He might easily be laid by the lee. He might easily give pain. And silence was better, until Stephen should mention her again. When they were aboard the ship once more, he sent the other targets out. The larboard watch had their turn with the guns, a slightly more creditable performance accompanied by a running fire of criticism, advice, and even praise from the quarterdeck, and then the surprise was indulged in two broadsides at much closer range. They were rippling broadsides, the guns firing in succession from forward aft, because her timbers were too old for the simultaneous crash except in great emergency. But private ships of war had to find themselves in powder, that costly substance, so in most of them broadsides, rippling or otherwise, were extremely rare, and all hands perceived these as a celebration of their triumph over the Viper. The celebration ended with the captain and the gunner firing the bow chasers, two very finely bored long brass nines, strikingly accurate far-carrying guns, Jack Aubrey's private property. They fired at the floating remains of the target shattered by the broadsides, and although neither did spectacularly well, they raised a fervent cheer. As Jack came aft, wiping the powder marks off his face, Martin said to Stephen, "Surely the captain is looking more himself, do not you think? Yesterday evening I was extremely shocked." The extreme edge of unhappiness might have gone, but there was still room for a very great deal of worry and anxiety. Quite apart from his strongly intrusive necessary reflections upon domestic and legal complications, and he was not the resilient, sanguine being of even a year ago, Jack had not realized the difficulty, the near impossibility, of recruiting a ship's company of much the same quality throughout. He had not realized how very far years of teamwork and constant practice on the same gun with the same partners had raised the old surprises beyond the common level. The privateersmen were strong and willing. In dumb show, the ordinary form of exercise, powder being so dear, they could rattle the guns in and out with great force and spirit.
but it was clear that months or even years would be needed to give them that perfect timing, coordination, and economy of effort that made the regular surprises so dangerous to their enemies. In the meantime, he could either restore the guns to their former crews, or he could change his strategy, and instead of weakening his opponent from a distance, perhaps even knocking a topmast away before manoeuvring to cross his bow or stern for a raking broadside and then, if necessary, boarding, he could follow Nelson's advice about going straight at him. But that advice was given early in the last war, when French and Spanish gunnery, French and Spanish seamanship, were so markedly inferior. At present, a ship bearing down with a light breeze over a smooth sea would be exposed head-on and unable to reply to the enemy's full broadside for 20 or 30 minutes, and she might well be so mangled by the time she came alongside that she would herself be taken. The biter bit. Then again, he had worked out his practice when he was commanding a king's ship, always happy, of course, to take an enemy merchantman or privateer, but primarily intended to take, burn, sink, or destroy the enemy's national ships of war. Now the case was altered. Now his chief prey was to be merchantmen or privateers, undamaged if possible, and that called for a different approach. Of course, three times of course, he would delight in an engagement with an opponent of equal strength belonging to the French or American Navy, a hard-hitting battle with no notion of financial gain. For a discarded privateer to take an enemy frigate would be glory indeed. But unhappily, the surprise, though fast and weatherly, belonged to a former age as far as glory was concerned. There were only 5 28-gun frigates left in the Royal Navy, and of these 5, 4 were laid up in ordinary, unused. Most frigates now displaced well over 1,000 tons, and carried 38 18-pounders as well as carronades, and the Surprise could no more have tackled one of them than she could have faced a ship of the line. She gauged less than 600 tons. She carried 12-pounders, and if her knees had not been specially strengthened to bear them, she would have been happier with 9s. And even with her full, extravagant Royal Navy complement, she had fewer than 200 men, as opposed to the more than 400 in one of the big Americans. Yet she was still a frigate, and for her there would be no glory in capturing anything of nominally inferior rank, such as the heavier post-ship and any of the sloops, ship-rigged or otherwise.
"Perhaps it would be better to go back to carronades," he reflected.
At one time, the Surprise, apart from her chasers, had been armed entirely with carronades, those stumpy little objects more like a mortar than a gun, which were light. A carronade throwing a 32-pound ball weighed only 1,700 weight, as opposed to the 12-pounder long guns 34, and easily managed. That gave the ship a broadside weight of metal of 456 pounds. To be sure, the 456 pounds could not be thrown very accurately, nor very far. These were short-range weapons, yet a carronade did not require great skill in the handling, and although its massive balls had a terrible smashing effect, liable to ruin or even sink a prize, the same weapon loaded with case shot cut up the enemy's rigging and cleared his open decks most efficiently. Above all, if they were crowded with men intending to board. Counting 400 shot to a canister, with a broadside of 14 carronades, that came to more than 4,000. And 4,000 iron balls, screaming across the deck at 1,674 feet a second, had a discouraging effect, even if they were fired by inexpert hands. Perhaps that was the right solution. Although, of course, it did away with all the finer points of a single-ship action— the high seamanship of manoeuvring for position, the deliberate firing of the most accurate guns separately at very long range, the rate of fire increasing as the range shortened until they were hammering it out yardarm to yardarm in the paroxysm of battle, an incessant roaring in deep clouds of smoke.
"But that belongs to an almost entirely different world," he reflected, "and I can hardly hope to be so fortunate as to know it again. Yet I believe I shall open my mind to Stephen."
As the captain of a king's ship, Jack Aubrey had never opened his mind on such matters to anyone. He had always been a silent captain in the matter of strategy, tactics, and the right course of action, and this was not from any theory, but because it seemed to him evident that a commander was there to command, rather than to ask advice or preside over a committee. He had known captains and admirals call a council of war, and the result had nearly always been a prudent retreat,
or at any rate an absence of decisive action. But now the case was altered. He was no longer commanding a king's ship, but a ship belonging to Dr. Maturin. He might find it impossible to believe with anything but the very top of his mind that Stephen could conceivably own the Surprise. Yet the fact was there. And although from the start they had agreed that the command of the frigate should be carried on in the former manner, with the captain having sole authority, he felt that some degree of consultation was the owner's due.
"Little do I know of naval battles," said Stephen, having listened attentively to the arguments for and against carronades. "For although I have been present at the dear knows how many, I have nearly always been present at a remove, under the waterline, waiting for the wounded or dealing with them, poor souls, and my views are scarcely worth the uttering. Still and all, in this case, why may not you endeavour to have your cake and eat it too? Why may you not train the new teams with much longer bouts of firing the great guns, and then, if that do not answer, changing to the carronades? For if I understand you right, you are determined not to have some crews made up of old Surprises and others of new."
"Exactly. That would be the best way of dividing the ship's company into two, and a most disagreeable division at that. The right gunners on the one hand and the boobies on the other. There is bound to be a certain amount of jealousy. I wonder that it has scarcely shown itself yet, and I should do anything not to increase it. A happy ship is your only efficient fighting ship, but as for blazing away without regard to see whether the boobies can be turned into right gunners, it would be far too expensive."
"Listen, my dear," said Stephen, "I honour your desire to save our joint venture every penny you can, but I deplore it too, for there are savings that defeat their own ends, so there are, and at times it seems to me that you pinch and scrape beyond what is right, beyond what is indeed useful to the cause. I am not to teach you your own profession, sure, but if a dozen barrels of powder a day will help make up your mind one way or another on a matter of such consequence, pray indulge me by using them. You often used to treat the ship to powder out of your own pocket when you were in funds from prize money, and at present an impartial accountant would not value the expense at 3 skips of a louse. And in any event, as far as guns and gunnery are concerned, you are to consider the immense saving brought about by Tom Pulling's knowledge of the world. The carronades did not have to be purchased." Tom Pulling's knowledge of the world by land was about the same as his captain's, and he too had been cruelly deceived before this, but he was intimately well acquainted with what might be called the limical world, that of the minor and middling officials who lived with one foot upon the shore and the other on the sea, master attendants and their seconds, people from the ordnance and navy boards and the like. And though in all ordinary matters he was as honest as the rising sun, he, like so many of his friends, looked upon government property as a world apart. He had gone down with Stephen when the Surprise was sold out of the service. He had feasted with many of his associates in the port, and the moment he learnt for sure of the frigate's new destination, he spoke privately to those whose province it was, pointing out that her guns were hopelessly old-fashioned, they could never be reissued now. The second reinforce and the muzzle astragal were in every case different from the present regulation piece, and it would not surprise him at all to learn that after so much wear they were in a sad state, honeycombed and only fit for scrap metal. His friends understood him perfectly well. And although the Surprise was not actually paid for carrying her own guns away to Shelmerston, she was, by way of gratification, allowed an equally defective set of carronades, which now made a small part of her 160 tons of ballast, stowed rather high to keep her stiff, in breaks fore and aft of her ground tier.
"No, indeed,"
said Jack, smiling. And after a moment he went on.
"The service's notion of morality is an odd one, and I should be puzzled to define it in some cases. Yet I think almost every sailor knows just about where to draw the line between culpable cababar and traditional friendly accommodation. And after all, Tom did part with enough to leave no one out of pocket, at least on a scrap metal basis. Nothing very criminal in that, I believe. Which reminds me of another thing. Punishment in a private man of war. You know what I think about flogging. I hate ordering it. And it had occurred to me to follow the quite usual practice in such ships of letting the hands decide the sentence."
"They would scarcely be very hard on their shipmates, I imagine," said Stephen.
"And yet they are, you know. During the great mutinies of 97, the men kept the ships in strict order, and if anyone misbehaved, I mean misbehaved according to their notions, the grating was rigged,
Sentences of 2, 3, and even 4 dozen were by no means uncommon.
You decided against it, I collect.
Yes, I did. I reflected that if there should be bad blood between the new and the old hands, and you know how very difficult it is for a mixed ship's company to settle down together at first, then if an old surprise were brought up for sentence, they might give him a really heavy dose. And I'm damned if I will have any of my men flogged like that.
Let us hope that the constant firing of the great guns will bring them better friends. I have often observed that extremely violent noise and activity go with good fellowship and heightened spirits. In the matter of extremely violent noise and activity, the Surprise's surgeon and his mate were well served in the following days. Jack took Stephen at his word, and not only was the latter part of the forenoon watch given over to real gunfire, but in the evening quarters invariably saw the ship stripped for action, roaring away, sometimes even firing both sides at once, jetting flame into the midst of a dark pall of smoke, a self-contained volcano. Martin was a quiet, humane being, and so, essentially, was Maturin. They both disliked the enormous din, not merely the great crash of the repeated explosions, but the roaring of the carriages as they rushed in and out, and the general thunder of feet racing to and from the magazines and shot lockers. They both disliked the murdering pieces themselves, and they particularly resented the way quarters would stretch out well into the last dog watch, at a time when the ship was reaching some particularly interesting waters from the naturalist's point of view. Not only did the Surprise keep up such an infernal bellowing that no bird, no mobile jellyfish or pelagic crab would stay between the same horizons with her, but they were confined to the orlop, their station in time of battle, and indeed of practice, for many an unfortunate was brought or even carried below with bruises, burns, crushed toes or fingers, and even once a broken leg. Occasionally Stephen would make his way up the ladders to the main hatchway and peer fore and aft along the busy deck, and it did his heart good to see Jack Aubrey hurrying from gun to gun in the smoke, sometimes violently lit by the great stabs of flame, sometimes a tall wraith advising the crews in a steady, wholly competent roar, shoving the awkward hands into the right position, sometimes clapping on to a side tackle to run the gun up, sometimes heaving on a crow to point it, always with the same eager, intense concentration and a look of grave satisfaction when the shot went home and the gun crew cheered. It was tense work, a very fair imitation of a real engagement, for the guns were fired so fast they soon heated and grew skittish, leaping high and recoiling with frightful force. Once Jumping Billy broke both breeching and after side tackle, and since there was a heavy swell from the southwest, the whole lethal mass of gun and carriage would have run amok on the deck if Padine, who was enormously strong, had not wedged it with a handspike until his mates could make all fast. They worked as quick as ever they could, but all this time Padine had to stand there with his excoriated hand pressed hard against the hot gun, so hot that his blood hissed as it ran down the metal. Bondon, the captain of the team, brought him below, openly weeping with the pain, and as they came he could be heard comforting him in the loud and distinct voice used for invalids, foreigners, and those who were not quite exactly. And Padine, for the moment, had all these qualifications.
"Never mind, mate. The doctor will soon put you right. What a rare Plucton you are, to be sure. You smell like a grilled beef steak, mate. He may save your poor bloody hand too, I dare say. Anyway, he will take away the pain."
And reaching up, for Padine was far taller, he gently wiped the tears from his cheeks. The doctor dealt with the pain, the very severe pain, by an heroic dose of laudanum, the alcoholic tincture of opium, one of his most valued medicines. "Here," he said in Latin to his mate, holding up a bottle of the amber liquid, "you have the nearest approach to a panacea that has ever been found out. I occasionally use it myself and find it answers admirably in cases of insomnia, morbid anxiety, the pain of wounds, toothache and headache, even hemicrania." He might well have added heartache too. But he went on, "I have, as you perceive, matched the dose to the weight of the sufferer and the intensity of the suffering. Presently, with the blessing, you will see Padine's face return to its usual benevolent mansuetude. and a few minutes later you will see him glide insensibly to the verge of an opiate coma. It is the most valuable member of the whole pharmacopoeia.
I am sure it is, said Martin. Yet are there not objections to opium eating? Is not it likely to become habitual?
The objections come only from a few unhappy beings, Jansenists, for the most part, who also condemn wine, agreeable food, music, and the company of women. They even call out against coffee, for all love. Their objections are valid solely in the case of a few poor souls with feeble willpower, who would just as easily become the victims of intoxicating liquors, and who are practically moral imbeciles, often addicted to other forms of depravity. Otherwise it is no more injurious than smoking tobacco. He corked his valuable flask, observed that he had a couple of carboys of it in the store from which it must be refilled, and went on. It is now some time since they stopped their hellish banging, so perhaps we might go and take a cigar on the quarter-deck. They can hardly object to a little more smoke up there, I believe. Padina, how do you come along?"
Padine, his mind soothed by the Latin and his pain by the drug, smiled but said nothing. Stephen, having repeated his question in Irish with no better result, desired Bondon to see him lashed carefully into a hammock so that his poor arm could not wave about, and led the way to the quarter-deck. Its emptiness startled him until he saw Mr. West poised in the mizzen shrouds and looking fixedly at the maintop, where the captain and Pullings could be seen with their parallel telescopes trained to the windward.
"Perhaps they have seen a Caspian tern," said Martin. "Mr. Pullings noticed the plate in your bouffon. I had it open in the gunroom, and he said he believed he had seen them quite often in these latitudes."
"Let us run up the rigging and surprise them," said Stephen, feeling a sudden unusual gaiety. It was indeed the sweetest evening, balmy, a golden sky in the west, and a royal blue swell, white along the frigate's side and in her wake. Several old surprises, Stephen's patience these many years, came hurrying aft along the gangway, calling, "Don't look down, sir! Don't clap onto them ratlins! Hold the shrouds, the thick ones, with both hands! Easy does it, sir! Don't let go on the roll, whatever you do!"
Presently anxious hands were placing their feet from below, up and up, a great way up, since the surprise had a 36-gun ship's mainmast, and presently two delighted faces gazed into the top through the lubber's hole.
"Do nothing rash!" cried Aubrey. "You have not come by your sea legs yet. This is no time for skylarking. Give me your hand."
He heaved Stephen and then Martin up onto the platform, and once again Stephen wondered at his strength. Stephen's bare 9 stone was perhaps natural enough, but Martin was far more stoutly built. For all that he was swung up with a lift as effortless as though he had been a moderate dog held by the nape, swung right up through the hole and set down on his feet. It was no Caspian tern that they were looking at, but a sail, and a sail no very great way off.
"What airs these 18-gun sloops do give themselves, to be sure," said Pullings in a discontented voice. "Look how she's cracking on. It will be Moonrakers next. I will lay 0.5 crown she carries away that for t'gallant stunsail in the next 5 minutes."
"Should you like to have a look at her, sir?"
asked Jack, passing Martin his glass. Martin clapped his one eye to it, silently recorded a stormy petrel, and after a pause exclaimed,
"It has fired a gun! I see the smoke. Surely it will never have the temerity to attack us."
"No, no, she is one of ours."
The boom reached them.
"That is a signal for us to lie to."
"Would it not be possible to feign deafness and to sail off in the opposite direction?" asked Stephen, who dreaded another encounter.
"Most private men of war avoid their public brethren if they can possibly outsail them," said Jack, "and the notion did occur to me when first she was sighted. But she altered course so quick, hauled her wind 5 points, that I am sure she recognised us. And if we were not to lie to after a gun, and this is the second, and if she were to report us, we might very well lose our letter of mark. Surprise is so damned recognisable. It is this most uncommon mainmast. You can smoke it 10 miles away, like a bear with a sore thumb. Tom, I believe we must use the spare stump t'gallant for ordinary cruising. We can always sway this one up for a determined chase."
Pullings did not answer. He crouched lower and lower over his telescope, poised on the top rail, focusing more exactly.
and all at once he cried, "Sir! Sir! She's the Tartarus!" Jack caught up his glass, and after a moment, and in what for him was a happy voice, he said,
"So she is! I can make out that absurd bright blue bumpkin."
Another gun, and he said,
"She has made her number. She will be signalling presently. William was always a great hand with the bunting."
Directing his voice downwards, he called,
"Mr. West, we will close the sloop under all plain sail, if you please, and let the signal yeoman stand by." "Yes," he went on to those in the top, as a distant line of flags appeared. "There he is. Such a hoist. Tom, I dare say you can read it without the book."
Pullings had been Jack's signal lieutenant, and he still had much of the list by heart. "I'll have a try, sir," he said, and slowly read out, "Welcome, repeat, welcome, happy sea, beg Captain Sup, have message, hope." Now he is telegraphing, "P-H-I-Z, the signal mid can't spell." On the quarterdeck, the yeoman of the signal's mate, a Shelmerstonian, asked, "What does the brig mean with her P-H-I-Z? "She means our doctor, which is not a common tuppence-a-go barber surgeon, but a genuine certified physician with a bob wig and a gold-headed cane."
"I don't know," said the Shelmerstonian, staring hard at the maintop.
"You don't know much, mate," said the yeoman, but not unkindly. "The approaching vessel is under the command of Mr. Babington," said Stephen to Martin. "You remember Mr. Babington at the cricket match?"
"Oh, yes," replied Martin. "He made several late cuts, most beautifully timed, and you told me he had played for Hambledon. I should be happy to see him again."
A little later he did see him again. The ships were lying to with their topsails backed, not very close because of the growing sea. The Tartarus, with great politeness, had run under the frigate's lee, and her captain, his face bright red with the pleasure and exertion, was urging Jack not to get his boats off the booms. Tartarus had quarter davits. Tartarus would lower her cutter down in a split second.
"Should be very happy, William," called Jack in a conversational voice that carried
easily over the 100 yards of sea.
"But it can only be a short visit. I have a great deal of southing to make up, and it is likely to turn dirty."
The cutter splashed down. The guests were pulled across, and Jack, forgetting for a moment that he was in no position to give orders, said to the midshipman in charge,
"Larboard side, if you please,"
for this meant no ceremony. Yet he recollected himself when the boat hooked on, and he made Pullings and Stephen, both King's officers, take precedence. The momentary awkwardness was drowned by Dr. Maturin's shrill indignation at the boatswain's chair that had been rigged to bring him aboard dry without anxiety.
"Why this injurious distinction?" he cried. "Am not I an old salt, a hardened sea dog?"
But his voice changed entirely as he was set down on deck and found his old shipmate James Mowat standing there to receive him.
"Why, James Mowat, joy! How happy I am to see you! But what are you doing here? I thought you were to be first of the illustrious."
"So I am, sir. William Babington is just giving me a lift to Gibraltar."
"Of course, of course. Tell, how does your book come along?"
Mowat's exceptionally cheerful face clouded slightly.
"Well, sir, publishers are most hellish," he began.
But Babington interrupted to welcome the doctor aboard, and eventually, laughing and talking, he shepherded them all into the cabin, where they found Mrs. Ray, a rather short-legged, swarthy young lady, but now downright pretty in her blushing confusion, her mixture of distress at being seen and her delight at seeing. Nobody was particularly surprised. All the men present had known one another at very close quarters for a very long time. The younger three had been in the midshipman's berth of Jack Aubrey's first command, and they all knew that Babington had been more attached to Fanny Hart, as she was before her marriage to Ray, than to any other of his innumerable flames. They might think it was coming a little high to sail about the main with the wife of the acting Second Secretary of the Admiralty Board, but they all knew that Babington was rich by land, with enough parliamentary votes in his family to protect him from anything but serious professional misconduct, and they all had at least some notion of Ray's reputation. The only person really surprised, concerned, upset, was Fanny herself.
She was particularly terrified of Mr. Aubrey, and sat as far from him as possible, wedged behind Stephen in a corner. Through the steady roar of voices he heard her whispering, "Looks so very odd, don't it? Almost compromising, so far from land. Feel quite uncomfortable. Am come for my health." Dr. Gordon positively insisted upon a short sea voyage. "Of course I have my own maid with me." "Dear me, oh yes. So very glad to see poor Captain Aubrey tolerably well, though dear me what the poor man must have been through. And indeed he does look somewhat ancient now, and who can be surprised, and rather severe. Shall I have to sit next to him at supper? But William has a letter from his wife, and perhaps that will mollify him." "My dear Fanny," said Stephen, "he needs no mollifying. He has always liked you, and if there were any stones to throw, he would never at any time reach for one. But tell me, last time we were talking about Captain Babington, you referred to him as Charles, which puzzled me, though no doubt he has several names to choose from, and prefers this to the others." "No, no," said Fanny, blushing again. "I was all confused that day. My mind, if you can call it one, was all of a fluster. We had been to Mrs. Graham's masked ball a little while before, me as a Highland sheep and William as the young pretender. How we laughed, oh Lord! So I went on calling him Charles for days afterwards. He was so beautiful in his filibeg. You will think me a pitifully simple ninny, I'm afraid. But, however, I am amazingly glad to hear what you tell about the captain's liking me. I shall sit next to him, quite happy now. Lord, how I hope the suet pudding ain't raw. William made such a point of it for him. He swears it can be done in a trice in a Papin's digester, but puddings always took hours and hours when I was a girl." Supper was a cheerful meal, with a great deal of talk and laughter, and merely from the animal point of view it was most uncommonly welcome after the surprises Spartan fare. At this point the frigate had no captain's cook and no gunroom cook. Jack had laid in no private stores out of economy, Stephen out of absent-mindedness, the gunroom out of stark poverty. They all lived on ship's provisions, and since the ship was still in home waters, they drank not grog but small beer or swipes, smaller by the day. The cabin's only luxury was breakfast, which Killick had provided for on his own authority. During the course of the meal, Babington told them how the Tartarus had chased an amazingly swift-sailing American schooner for 2 days and a night, a certain blockade runner trying to get into Brest or Lorient. "I sent up light hawsers and cablets just as you used to do, sir," he said, "and I really believe we should have had her if both main and fore topsails had not blown out of their bolt ropes at the same moment. Yet at least we set her 300 or 400 miles south of her course, and she will have to run the whole gauntlet again before she sees the coast of France." "Mr. Mowat," called Stephen, in the pause while the table was clearing to make room for the pudding, and pudding wine, in this case Frontignan and Canary, were handing about. "You were telling me about your publishers." "Yes, sir. I was about to say that they were the most hellish procrastinators." "Oh, how dreadful," cried Fanny. "Do they go to special houses? Or do they—"
"He means they delay," said Babington.
"Oh.
Yes, the book was supposed to come out on the glorious 1st of June. Then it was put off to Trafalgar Day, and now they say nothing but the anniversary of Camperdown will really suit the public mind. Yet at least it has this advantage. I can polish what is already down, and I can add a new piece I have written."
"Tip us the new piece, Mowat," said Pullings.
"Yes, do," said both Babington and Fanny.
"Well," said Mowat, with mixed pleasure and modesty, "it is rather long. So, if I may, ma'am," bowing to Fanny, "I will just say the end verses. It is about a battle, and these lines are meant to show the carnage at its height. Swift o'er the deep with winged speed they flew, and nearer now the frowning squadrons drew. Quick, clear the decks, the shrill-voiced boatswain cries. Quick, clear the decks, each hollow ship replies. Pale grows each cheek with strange unwonted fear. All stand a moment, lost in fixed amaze, in awful silence and unconscious gaze." A crash somewhere forward, not unlike the firing of a 12-pounder, interrupted him, but only for a moment.
"Death strides from ship to ship with sweeping scythe. On every poop damned fiends of murder writhe.
Demons of carnage ride the empurpled flood, champ their fell jaws and quaff the streaming blood.
"Oh, sir, if you please,"
cried a tall, pale, frightened midshipman at the cabin door.
"Mr. Cornwallis's duty, but the digesting machine has burst."
"Is anyone hurt?" asked Babington, rising.
"No one actually did, sir, I believe, but—"
"Forgive me," said Babington to his guests. "I must go and see."
"How I hate foreign inventions," said Fanny in the anxious pause.
"Nobody dead," said Babington, returning, "and the surgeon says their scalds are of no consequence. We'll heal in a month or so. But I am very much concerned to have to tell you, sir, that the pudding is spread just about equally over the cook and his mates and the deckhead. They thought it might cook quicker if they put a smoothing iron on the safety valve."
"It was a pity about the pudding," said Jack, when they were back in the cabin of the Surprise. "But upon the whole, I have rarely enjoyed a supper more. And although Fanny Hart may be neither Scylla nor Charybdis, they are very, very fond of one another, and when all is said and done, that is what really signifies." On his way down to Pompey, William looked in at Ashgrove Cottage to ask Sophie how she did, and she gave him a note for me in case we should meet. "All is well at home, and my mother-in-law is less of a trial than you might suppose. She declares I am cruelly ill-used, and that Sophie and I deserve all her sympathy. It is not that she supposed for a moment that I am innocent, but that she thoroughly approves of what she thinks I did. If she had the least opportunity, she would certainly do the same, and so would any other woman who had a proper sense of duty towards her capital." "Surely that is not the Marseillaise you are picking out?"
Stephen had his cello between his knees, and for some time now he had been very quietly stroking two or three phrases with variations upon them, a half-conscious playing that interrupted neither his talk nor his listening.
"It is not," he said. "It is, or rather it is meant to be, the Mozart piece that was no doubt lurking somewhere in the Frenchman's mind when he wrote it. Yet something eludes me."
"Stephen," cried Jack, "not another note, I beg. I have it exactly, if only it don't fly away."
He whipped the cloth off his violin case, tuned roughly, and swept straight into the true line. After a while, Stephen joined him, and when they were thoroughly satisfied, they stopped, tuned very exactly, passed the rosin to and fro, and so returned to the direct statement, to variations upon it, inversions, embroideries, first one setting out in a flight of improvisation, while the other filled in, and then the other doing the same, playing on and on, until a lee lurch half flung Stephen from his seat so that his cello gave a dismal screech. He recovered, bow and strings unharmed, but their free-flowing rhythm was destroyed and they played no more.
"It is just as well, however," said Jack. "I should very soon have been most damnably out of tune. During the great gun exercise I ran up and down without a pause, doing what half a dozen midshipmen usually do, each for his own set of guns. I never knew the little brutes were so useful before, and now I am quite fagged out." "Hold hard, Stephen," he cried, catching Stephen as he fell again, this time from a standing position. "Where are your sea legs?"
"It is not a question of sea legs at all," said Stephen. "The ship is moving about in a very wild, unbridled manner. A crocodile would fall in such circumstances, without it had wings."
"I said it was going to be a dirty night," said Jack, walking over to the barometer. "But perhaps it is going to be dirtier than I thought. We had better snug down here as well. Killick, Killick there!"
"Sir,"
said Killick, appearing instantly with a padded cloth under his arm.
"Strike the doctor's cello and my fiddle down into the bread-room, together with the article."
"Aye, aye, sir. The doctor's cello and your fiddle down into the bread-room it is, together with the object."
Early in their marriage, Diana had given Stephen a singularly splendid but nameless example of the cabinet-maker's art and ingenuity. It could be, and generally was, a music-stand, but various levers and flaps turned it into a wash-basin, a small but quite adequate desk, a medicine-chest, and a bookcase, and it had seven secret drawers or compartments. It also contained an astrolabe, a sundial, a perpetual calendar, and a quantity of cut-glass bottles and ivory brushes and combs. But what really pleased Killick was the fact that its hinges, keyhole scutcheons, door straps, finger plates, bottle stoppers, and all other fittings were massive gold. He took idolatrous care of it. The padded cloth was only the innermost of its three rough-weather cases, and he thought his captain's name for it improper, disrespectful, and out of place. Object was the appropriate word, a word that had not the remotest connection with chamber pot, but on the contrary, with holiness. Holy object. And steadily, for years, Killick had tried to impose it. Jack stood there for some moments, swaying easily with a twisting roll and pitch. His mouth was poised for whistling, yet in fact it was not music at all that ran through his mind, but a set of calculations of positions, currents, wind force and the changing barometric pressure, all set against the immediate past and a background of a great many similar patterns in this part of the Atlantic. He put on a pilot jacket, made his way to the quarterdeck and considered again, this time more instinctively, taking the feel of the wind at the sea directly. The topgallant masts had already been struck, the hatches battened down, deadlights shipped and the boats on the booms double-griped. He said to Davidge,
"When the larboard watch is called, let the topsails be close-reefed. Call me if there is any change in the wind. Captain Pullings relieves you, I believe."
"Yes, sir."
"Then let him know what I have said. Good night to you, Mr. Davidge."
"Good night, sir."
Back in the cabin, he observed,
"This may be the blow I was talking about when I said that an action or a storm pulled a mixed crew together wonderfully. I wish I may not have spoken like a fool. I wish it may not have been thought I desired a really violent blow."
"My godfather's great-great-grandmother lived at Avila, in a house that I shall show you and Sophie when the war is done. She knew St. Teresa, and the saint told her that more tears were shed over prayers that were granted than ever were shed over prayers that were refused."